Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Exploring our oneness with Spirit and each other. Unity Online Radio. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome the author of a moving, insightful book about a father's experience in contacting and learning from his dead son. It's entitled Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. The author, Matthew McKay, PhD, is a clinical psychologist. He's a professor at the prestigious Wright Institute in Berkeley, California. He's co-authored a number of books on professional self-help psychology. This is his first foray, though, into the universe of conscious connection and communion with the dead. And it's made all the more poignant, of course, because it centers around his ongoing relationship with his son, who was shot one night in San Francisco. And so it's a pleasure to welcome Matthew McKay to today's show. Glad you're with us, Matthew.
I'm glad to be with you, Paul. Thank you very much.
You know, the book's very life-affirming, isn't it, in the sense that no one is lost, right? We're all in this together. Life continues, and there's more going on than meets the three-dimensional viewpoint.
That's absolutely right. I've learned that the living and the dead, the relationship is not lost. We all are still together. We're all still connected by love. And that we actually can communicate back and forth. And that lesson has been enormously important to me, and I hope can be of value to others.
And, of course, you know, you mentioned in the book a few times that this is sort of counterintuitive for you, that, you know, as a clinical psychologist, somebody that values the scientific method, et cetera, you know, you're not the most likely person to go into what sometimes is viewed as sort of the woo-woo area psychic awareness and clairvoyance, clairaudience, telepathy, and all those things, making contact with souls, and yet there's a growing literature, isn't there, of books and studies pertaining to this, you know, pertaining to this connectedness that we have with the people who are supposedly dead, right? They're only dead in one sense, not in truth. And you have a beautiful quote at the beginning of the book. See if I can find it, from W.S. Merwin, the great poet, wrote, "The bird lies still while the light goes on flying." I love that, because so many permutations, and there's so many things you could draw from that line there. But, you know, the bird, your son, died suddenly, unexpectedly, tragically, but that was not the end of the story, right?
That was not the end of the story, and the light goes on flying because the love that connects us continues and is, my experience is completely accessible. And you're right. I mean, my life has been randomized controlled trials and scientific investigations of therapy processes and methods, and I did not expect to discover something that requires a very different way of thinking. It requires an openness and willingness to accept experiences that you can't measure and you can't scientifically prove. So it's been a very different journey for me, but it was a journey that I felt I had to take. When Jordan died, from almost the moment I learned of his death, I felt absolutely determined to find some way to reach him and to, I think, discover the two, you know, answer the two questions that people who've lost someone they love struggle with most. You know, the first one is that person, is that soul, does it still, that soul still exist? Is there still a way to reach them, to connect to them? And the other question is that soul okay? Was Jordan still all right? Was he happy where he was? So those were the two questions, and I just felt compelled to find answers to them.
And I want to get into the nature of souls, too, because, you know, in many traditions, this idea of the discrete soul, you know, doesn't necessarily exist as such. But the way you describe it in the book, it's almost as if that's okay, too, because it's much more subtle than whether it's, you know, discrete or whether there's no essential soul. It's more of a connection to the universal. And you know, at one point you mentioned that you know, souls or people are both in the spirit world and in the embodied world at the same time, and that's kind of interesting too. And it would fit in with quantum physics, wouldn't it, that we can be both, you know, a particle and a wave, and we have tendencies towards things, and so, you know, we have a greater freedom than we allow ourselves, maybe in our more conditioned existence. You made that trip to Chicago, right, initially to talk with, I think his name was Alan Botkin.
And he
taught, what is it, induced after-death communication. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Botkin is a clinical psychologist, and he worked for many years at the VA with traumatized vets, mostly Vietnam vets. And he uses a method called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a very well-established method for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. I use it myself with my own patients. And but he, while he was working with a particular vet who had a great loss of a young girl that he had befriended in Vietnam and was planning to adopt and then was killed by a bomb, he was working with his vet using EMDR and just inadvertently made a small change in the protocol, just a small variation in this protocol for doing the eye movement technique. And the vet suddenly had a full-blown vision, and he could hear this young girl talking to him. She had very specific messages to him. And the man came out of the experience with absolute certainty that he had communicated to her, and he felt extraordinary relief. He felt real healing, and so Botkin was just amazed, and he didn't know what he'd done exactly, and he figured out the small change or variation he made in the EMDR protocol, and he started researching it, and he worked with 83 vets, and he didn't tell them what to expect. He was just they were just assuming they were getting help with their trauma. But in 81 out of 83 cases, with this small variation of the treatment, they had actual communications to loved ones who had died and who they were deeply grieving. And so the fact is that he had about a 96% success rating doing this without warning or telling them what to expect. All of these men had these extraordinary experiences of communicating. And so Botkin called his new variation of the treatment induced after-death communication. So I went to Chicago to have that experience. I went through the process, and I had the experience of hearing Jordan, hearing his voice, the timbre, the quality, the tone of his voice, exactly as it had been. He had very specific things to say to me. He had very specific messages for his mom. And he conveyed the two things I needed to know. One was that he existed. He still loves us. He's aware of us. He's watching over us. But also that he's in a good place, and feels happy and content. So I felt this amazing lightness after this experience. It was about 7 months after his death, and I mean it was really the first time I felt any kind of hope or relief, and so I took that experience, and it meant so much to me to have those two questions answered, but at the same time I wanted also to have a conversation with him. I wanted to be able to talk back and forth and ask him questions and hear answers, and so I had to kind of continue with my journey to find new ways of communicating with him in a more conversational way.
But that moment of hearing his voice and getting that confirmation that he was okay, I think it's priceless, isn't it? I did about 25 years after my dad died, I did a regression or whatever with a therapist, and we went to a mountain that my dad and I used to climb a lot, and there was a sort of a gully at the top, sort of a nice grassy place where you could lie down, and I lay down there in my mind, and next thing I know, my dad's there, and he says, "Son, it's been a long time, son." And that's all he said. It wasn't a huge conversation, but just the fact that he was there and saying that, that had been a long time. I felt my heart opening, my vortex opened, and I started crying intensely, and it was just so real. You couldn't, like you said earlier, you couldn't prove it scientifically, but I knew it was a real contact with Dad, immensely calming. It's the idea that all is well, right? And that's what your son said to you too. It's okay. I'm all right. Everything's fine. And he kept reaffirming this, didn't he, in all these subsequent conversations, that this life is not limited by birth or death, and it's actually everything's for learning, right?
Everything's for learning. And what a beautiful experience you had to hear those words from your dad, and I know how much that means, the relief and the sense of still being connected.
Yes.
And that knowing that death doesn't change anything, that whether we are on the other, in the spirit world, or whether we're here, that souls remain connected, and the barrier of death is really, in terms of soul life, it doesn't really exist. The people on the other side, the souls on the other side who are in spirit, are available to us, and they're just a thought away. Literally, when we think of them, we are opening the channel to communication. As soon as we think of them, they are consciously aware of us.
Right.
The channel opens, and it's possible at that moment to have real communication. We can say things to them. We can hear answers back, and the truth of that is such. We come here, and we have total amnesia for the spirit world. We remember nothing, and there's good reasons for that. Because if we didn't forget where we came from, and didn't forget the spirit world, we wouldn't take seriously the struggles that we have here. We wouldn't learn the lessons that we've come here to learn. So. The amnesia is important, but on the other hand, we come here with this tremendous sense of aloneness. We really don't recall all of these connections in love that exist between us and other souls and between us and all of consciousness. So that's an extraordinary loss that is illusory, but we feel it nonetheless. And so learning that we can communicate at will to souls on the other side bridges that aloneness and can once again give us a sense of reconnection.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I like that idea. There's no time or space to spirit, is there, or to this universal awareness. So when we open up the channel through thought, that person can be there. My daughter always imagines that her mother, who died of breast cancer, about 14 years ago now, you know, is with her whenever she sees a butterfly, you know. And you could say, well, you know, is that true? But I think because she thinks that the butterfly is her mother, then the butterfly becomes her mother at that moment, you know, because she's tuned in, and so there's no reason why the soul of that person can't enter that butterfly. We have a memorial bench where we go sometimes on the river, and the last time we went there, I think, or the time before last, actually, a butterfly landed on my daughter's head, you know, and walked with us the whole way, and then it transferred itself to me and walked all the way to the bench and then stayed a while and then flew off. And it was just too coincidental, you know. Here's this butterfly sharing both of us, and it's almost a reminder, you know, I'm still with you, all is well. And That was quite a remarkable experience. And some people might say, oh, well, that's just plain silly. You know, you're trying to make things up. But, you know, I think anything in life is silly if that's all you can see, right? But if you want to tune in to the more subtle realms, they're available.
They are. And I think the souls on the other side choose animals, objects, that they can use to connect to us. Uh-huh. And as soon as we see that animal or object, the channel opens instantly.
Yeah, it triggers it for us.
And it's right there. And I think souls are very adept at using those opportunities, and whether they are actually directing the animal or the butterfly, or they simply are taking the opportunity that the animal or butterfly is there to open the channel. Whichever it is, the channel opens, and they are present, and we are able to connect to them at that moment. My wife and I have the same thing with hummingbirds. With Jordan, for us, immediately we experience his presence when we see a hummingbird, and we've had those experiences like you did, where the hummingbird stays around a long time and seems to be very curious about us, and those are moments where again the relationship is suddenly alive, is present, and if you want, you can actually send messages and receive them. Your soul on the other side is listening.
Right, and that's a big part of the book too, the word listening, right? It's listening not just with our outer ears, but with that attunement, you know. And I think Jesus talked about this when he said, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. He obviously wasn't talking about just awareness from the sense of hearing, but from that inner sense of listening and paying attention to, which is very profound. I think if there's one thing that's the most profound thing we can ever do on the spiritual path, and that is to look and to listen. Because when we start to truly look and listen, we see all kinds of things opening up for us that we could never see with our ordinary eyes or hear with our ordinary ears. And, you know, you talk about this a lot, don't you, in terms of channeled writing, automatic writing. And I think it was you visited another person with expertise in this, Ralph Metzner, and sort of began channeled writing. Tell us about that.
So I wanted to continue to talk to Jordan, but I wanted to be able to ask questions and get answers in the way that we did over so many hundreds of conversations at the kitchen table. In his lifetime, I wanted to actually see if that was possible to still do across the barrier of life and death, and so Metzner taught me how to do channeled writing, which is really an ancient technique and art that is references in ancient writings going back several thousand years of how to do this. And it's in a way it's very simple. You just need a few elements. One is you need to be at one consistent place where you do the channeled writing. It's a place where you feel centered, and you maybe something that connects you to your own history, your own past, people you love from the past. I sit at a desk that my parents gave me when I was a boy, and it's a place that I've spent a lot of time, and also it reminds me of people who I love. So that's the place where I get centered. And the next thing you need is a focusing object. And a lot of people just use candles. I do. I have a candle that sits behind a blue glass mask that my daughter gave me. She got it in Mexico. I use that. I focus my attention on the candle. You also need an object that connects you to the person on the other side. In my case, it's a little business card that Jordan had printed up when he was in high school, really, and it just says Jordan McKay, CEO, Omega Technologies. And there was no Omega Technologies. It was just a complete sham, but he used it to get into tech shows and conventions. And it reminds me of his humor and his ingenuity, and it makes me smile when I look at it. So that object is the one I use to connect to him.
Right.
And then you need to create an inner sense of receptivity. And I use just traditional Vipassana meditation of just focusing on the breath, watching the breath, keeping when thoughts come into my mind, noticing the thought, but returning my full attention to the breath again. And I keep doing that until I feel subjectively like I'm ready, like I'm receptive, I'm ready to listen to Jordan. At that point, the conversation begins by writing a question down, physically writing the question that you have for the loved one on the other side. I'll write a question, and I'll wait a moment, and for me, usually the first thing that happens is a word shows up. I'm just aware of a word, and then a sentence follows that word. And then a string of sentences will fall, often coming so fast that I can barely write to catch up. And that will continue until there's just silence again. There's nothing. And the answer to my question has been completed. I write the next question, and I get another answer. And most of the book, Seeking Jordan, the majority of it was written that way. Essentially, I was taking dictation. From Jordan,
right.
I ask him questions, and I take
dictation.
When we just decided to write the book, I asked him if this was something he wanted to do. Actually, Ralph Messner suggested we do it, and I thought it was kind of a strange idea to write a book with someone who was in spirit. And Jordan said, oh, yeah, well, that'd be fine. And within 5 minutes, he outlined every chapter of the book, basically what the chapter would be about. And for the next year and a half, I just pretty much would ask him questions about each of the elements that he had outlined and just take listen to his answers. So that's how much of it came about.
Wow. All right. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about what actually appeared in those writings. I'm with Matthew McKay. We're talking about his wonderful book, Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. Join us after these messages from Unity.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
Hello, listeners. Did you know we've gone mobile? That's right. Your favorite Unity Online radio programs are available on your mobile device. Now you can take us with you wherever you go. Using apps from Live365 or Stitcher, you can listen to Unity Online Radio live or on demand. To learn more, visit Unity Online Radio and click on Mobile Listening.
I will leave this world as it is.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find my God.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, so welcome back to our second part of the show today. I'm with Matthew McKay, and we're talking about his book, Seeking Jordan, How He Lost His Son to a Tragic Killing, and but remained in contact with him, and some of the things that he learned. And a lot of things that Matthew learned was through automatic or channeled writing. And some of us who studied English will remember that W.B. Yeats also got involved with automatic writing at one point in his life. But it has a long tradition. And many books in the New Age movement of a so-called channel, too. But I think it's opening to that larger realm that's available to all of us, and we can all contact it, right? It's not limited to special people or psychics or whatever. But it's a question of attuning ourselves and having the desire, I guess, to want to make that contact. I think that the passion for it is crucial here. And obviously, Matthew had a lot of volition, passion towards wanting to be in contact with his son. There is a plan, right? That's one thing we learned from Jordan. There's a larger plan.
Yeah, in a general sense, our plan coming to this planet always involves learning. We are here to learn. Individual souls enter the physical life really with a lesson plan. There's pretty specific things that we're working on from Jordan. Jordan's perspective, or what he's told me, is that we have many lives. We have come back again and again. We come back with a small group of souls that often we reincarnate together with them over many lives, and learning from them in lots of different kinds of relationships. But that there is a lesson plan, and each time we return to this planet, we return with a plan of what we're going to learn in that particular life. And we take that learning back to the spirit world, and what we have learned becomes available and part of all of consciousness, of the whole, of the divine. What we learn contributes to all of consciousness and to the wisdom and knowledge of all of consciousness. So it's my understanding from Jordan is that we have a very sacred mission here. You could think of it maybe as bees in a hive. The bees, the individual souls, go out and gather nectar, which is wisdom, knowledge, learning, and they bring it back to the hive for the whole to feed all of, in our case, all of consciousness. To feed.
Right.
So it's a really beautiful thing that we struggle and we go through an incredible amount of pain. And from Jordan's point of view, the pain is really a necessary part of the learning. There are things you can't learn in the spirit world. Love in the spirit world is effortless. It's telepathic. There are no blocks, no obstacles. And we come here to learn how to love in the face of pain, in the face of emotional, physical and relational obstacles. And so it's a very, these are very hard lessons. So in general, we're learning how to love with and through pain. And it's and so only in a physical world can we have these kinds of lessons. And that's why we keep coming here.
Again, yes, it's counterintuitive, isn't it? But and yet this is something that, of course, all religions have struggled with, the idea of theodicy, you know, justifying the ways of God to man. Why is there suffering? Why, you know, why is there pain? And, you know, when we're going through it and when it's visited in horrific ways on multiple people, like it was, say, in the Holocaust, it's hard to see that there's, you know, that there's learning from that. But obviously there is. And, you know, we don't have to, there's two arrows out there, according to the Buddhist tradition, of the arrow of suffering, and then the second arrow is the internalization of that suffering and creating a story and a pain body around it, you know. And so if we can learn from our suffering, but without it becoming, you know, a huge story of abuse and sorrow and sadness in our lives, I think then maybe we learn that lesson. And it seems that's what, you know, Jordan learned, right? Because he understood that, in many ways, that it was necessary for him to die in the way that he did, and it wasn't a terrible tragedy. It was part of the unfolding of his consciousness and how others were interacting with that. So there's a larger picture here going on than what we can see.
That's right, and so there were lessons from his death that were touching so many souls, and those lessons continue to this day. And when we suffer, we usually ask the question, "How can I get rid of this?" And why am I suffering? What have I done wrong? How?
Yes.
And so we start making up stories about why we're suffering, and maybe we blame ourselves or we blame somebody else. And the whole focus is to do something to get rid of it, to get back to a state of happiness. What I'm learning from Jordan is that the question to ask when you're suffering is not how do I get rid of it, but what can I learn from this? This came for a reason. This is part of the lesson plan of this life. This pain is something that I can learn from. There's wisdom that I can find in this pain if I turn toward it rather than turning away from it.
Right.
Instead of trying to get rid of it or suppress it or block it out, let me turn toward it and learn what can be learned here. Because the object of life is not happiness per se. The object of life is learning and living our life purpose. And there will always be pain that's part of that. In fact, very often moving toward life purpose, there's inevitability of pain as we move toward life purpose, because these obstacles are going to show up and we have to somehow face them.
So John Lennon was right, wasn't he, when he said God is a concept by which we measure our pain. He was more profound maybe than even he realized, you know, that's a profound statement. You know, as I mentioned earlier, my wife, the first wife, died of breast cancer, and we were in the hospital, and she was pretty much in the coma for the last 6 days, and I kept the vigil there 24 hours a day, and after she passed, I remember going into the bathroom and having this amazing experience of this huge, huge field, and it just came out of nowhere, this just massive field full of flowers. And then my wife's voice said, "Oh, Paul, it's wonderful here. It's just glorious here." And it just blew my mind. You know, it was the idea that I felt I was feeling what she was experiencing as she passed over. And you talk about landings, right? They land in a place that's comfortable for them. But it was so, talk about an affirmation that all was well, you know, this idea that she'd, you know, ended up in this field of flowers that was vaster than you could imagine. And it was infinite, really, I guess. But it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. And she wanted to share it with me, presumably. So I got that mind vision of it. It was very fascinating.
What a gorgeous experience, beautiful experience to be able to see and have her share that landing with you, and for you to know at that moment that the pain was gone and she was in this beautiful place. That was a beautiful gift that you got. And you know, and in so many cases, sadly, when the people that need visitations, that need to hear from the loved one who's crossed over, don't get to hear much, because the grief so often blocks the channel of communication. That's not always the case, but it often is the case that the person who's most sad, most grieving, that the emotion of grief can sometimes get in the way of actually having that open channel to the other side. And that was the case with Judy and I for a while. For a number of months after Jordan's death, we really were having no sense of him, and we were just kind of lost in the pain. And yet all around us, friends and family were having visitations. He was showing up in dreams and visions. He was having specific messages for us through other people, since we weren't listening, we weren't able to hear. He was sending messages through others. And I think this is something I would really encourage people to be aware of. When someone you love deeply dies, you may not be the first to hear from them. And encourage family and friends to be aware of and open to communications and messages and dreams and so forth. So because you will get messages, it may come through other people at first.
We
called them Jordan sightings, and we had dozens of them from people we knew before we actually started having our own experiences.
Now, some cynical person's going to say, oh, this is just wish fulfillment. You know, you're reading into things. You're seeing things that aren't there. It's comforting for people who can't deal with the harsh reality of, you know, three-dimensional existence. And you have to have this sort of cozy little connection there. How would you respond to those sort of hard-bitten types?
Well, you know, I think, and I know people like this, and I know people who think that, you know, I'm sort of delusional because I've felt so much pain. I've just kind of created this story to somehow assuage it. And I guess what I say to people is, well, you can only have an experience if you have it. And I've had these experiences. I've heard Jordan's voice. I've used channeled writing. I've used past life and between life regressions, hypnotic regressions, to go look and see what's there, and to communicate to Jordan that way through regressions. And I've made these efforts, and I've had these experiences. And no one can tell me that I didn't have the experience. We can interpret it differently. It could, you know, it's possible it's wishful thinking. And, you know, and when you're seeking, as we are, there's always doubt. There's no absolute reality. We can't say for sure what the spirit world is. We get information about it through channel writing and regressions and through other people's experiences, we learn about it, but no one can be sure. And so there's always doubt, and I'll say that to people. You know, I don't mind that you feel doubt. I struggle with doubt, too. But I've also had lots of confirming experiences that have helped me hold on to this deep sense that that Jordan is talking to me. So we just have to live with that.
Well, you have chapters on the nature of doubt, don't you, and uncertainty, and I think uncertainty can be creative, actually. The Zen Buddhist tradition, you know, talks about great faith great doubt and great persistence, and marrying those three together, you know, you have a successful life. And, you know, when I was a kid, it was like you could never doubt. You know, if you believed in God, you know, you had to have total faith all the time, and doubt was your greatest enemy. But I love the Zen teaching that, you know, it's not. It's part of the balance here, you know, that to remain open, skeptical, you know, investigative of these things is fine, right? There are levels of uncertainty and mystery, but be persistent in you know, keeping going with this. And as you say, your experience is valid because you had it, and it you know, and over a period of time. I think if it's wish fulfillment, sometimes things happen and then they peter out or whatever. But if there's a consistency of information that seems to be very valid, then it would seem like there's something meaningful there, right?
That's exactly my experience. If there's a consistency of information, because all I am is one person, one voice who's saying, well, here's my experience. But when you listen to the many people who have had experiences and start saying, well, what do these experiences have in common? If I listen to all of this, what is it pointing to? What does it suggest about the nature of life and why we're here and what the spirit world is about? And you begin to feel like they're spokes on a wheel that are all pointing to a central axis, a central truth. And so each one of us who's just a voice and who has just a single experience are adding our voices and adding our experiences to the collection of what we know and experience and hear about the other side. I mean, let me give you an example. You know, Michael Newton wrote a book called Journey of Soul, a very beautiful book. He's a psychologist and a hypnotherapist. And he accidentally, and you may know about it, but he accidentally, while doing a past life regression, popped his client into something he didn't even know what was going on, but it later learned that she had entered the life between lives and had gone into the spirit world and was describing things to him that he had never heard of or had made no sense in some way. And so he ended up doing these regressions with about 7,000 people before he ever published a book. And they all had remarkable agreement about what the afterlife looks like and what we do there and what kinds of experiences we have in the afterlife. And so all of these people were describing something that was remarkably similar, but unprompted. So when you have these individual experiences, they all add up to something.
You know, and again, reductionists would say, well, that's because, you know, the biochemistry of the brain creates the same experiences for each of us, even though we're different bodies, we're experiencing a similar thing. But, you know, I'm not a reductionist myself. I think, you know, that there's a lot more going on than that. But, you know, if you don't want to see it, you don't see it, right? If you insist on being you know, a reductionist or an atheist in this regard, then we can't see anything else. Likewise, if you insist on being a fundamentalist religionist, you know, they can only see one way of the things can develop. And you talk about that too, that Jordan didn't really subscribe to, or describe, I should say, a typical, you know, Christian afterlife, right? There wasn't a whole lot of angelic choirs and you know, God shining light on everything. And there's certainly no heaven or hell as much as a continuing of the learning experience. So a little different to some of the traditional ideas we have around what happens after death.
Well, he's been very clear with me that we're not here to earn salvation in that traditional way of thinking. We're not here to win our way into heaven and to avoid hell. That in fact, the afterlife is just a place where we continue to learn, and we actually do a lot of digesting of the most recent life we've lived, and we spend time studying the Akashic record and what exactly did we do in that life, and how did it affect people. One of the things we can learn in the afterlife that we don't have access to here is seeing how each decision we make, each choice we make, affects everyone around us, not only at the moment, but over time. And so in the afterlife, we study that. We do a life review. We look at every single thing we did, every choice we made in our entire existence on this particular life on this planet. And we can see how each choice affected everyone around us, and we experience their experience. We actually feel what it was like for them to be on the other side of that choice, of that action that we took. And we watch our whole life. We review our whole life in that way. So we're doing this awareness, not only from our own point of view, but everybody else's, and over time how that individual choice affected them. It's extraordinary, and it's the kind of lessons that we can't have access to here because we can't get that 360 experience of how we affect others.
Go ahead.
But we go to the afterlife, and that's part of what we get to learn there that we can't learn here.
And I was going to say that, you know, the more advanced souls on this planet are doing exactly that. You know, they're bringing that sort of 360 viewpoint down into Earth, you know, that we are encouraged to be more compassionate and empathetic so we can understand what another person is thinking. And it's almost like, you know, for the most of us, we have to go to that other realm to experience that. But, you know, part of the work, isn't it, is bringing that next level of consciousness, which obviously is experienced there in the between states, into this current state. And so we're continuing the evolution of consciousness, if you like. I think this is part of Jordan's message to us, that this is an ongoing process. And you know, I do want to, before we get to the end of the show, I do want to talk about, you know, what exactly are souls, because I had dinner with a professor last week who, fascinating man. He's just been, they created a chair in his name, or in his honor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And I think it's a chair around contemplative studies and healthy mindedness. But he's a Buddhist. In fact, he was the translator for the Dalai Lama for a number of years. And a fascinating man, Dr. John Dunn. But, you know, he's basically coming from a Buddhist humanist point of view, and says, well, there is no such thing as a soul, you know, in the sense that Christian might think of it as a discrete entity. It's more a collection of tendencies that unfold, and there is rebirth or whatever, but it's not exactly, you know, a limited idea of a person, so to speak. Does that fit into your experience with Jordan, that, you know, he's more than just Jordan, right?
Well, he is and he isn't. I mean, my experience through him and what he's telling me is that we do remain individual souls. We have individual memories of our particular lives that we've lived, our incarnations. We can remember the lessons of those lives. We can remember the events of those lives. And we have a certain identity as a soul. It's a little different than the identity we have in a body, which is so much determined by our nervous system and physical structures of the body. But as a soul, we also have a certain identity which has to do with what we've experienced and what we've learned. We also even have preferences as souls. There are things that, you know, souls are attracted to certain things and drawn to certain kinds of experiences, and other souls are drawn to different experiences. So there is an identity that we have, but the soul, the individual soul, also exists collectively. And from what Jordan describes to me is that we oscillate back and forth when we're in spirit. We oscillate back and forth between that sense of our own individual awareness and identity, and being merged into the collective, into the whole, into the divine. And we actually kind of resonate back and forth between these experiences. And we have both experiences. We have both the sense of being part of a whole, of almost dissolving into the whole and absorbing the knowledge of the whole, of the divine, of all of consciousness. And at the same time retaining some of our own individuality. So So this process continues infinitely. There's always a little bit of our own soul self that we do hold on to, even though we go through moments of merging and connecting.
Right.
So his experience, he would describe that both things are true. We're both able to be one and retain a degree of our own soulness.
And again, that would fit in with, you know, quantum understanding, wouldn't it? That, you know, it's a both-ends universe. We can have tendencies towards both of these things without them being mutually exclusive. And
exactly.
I like that idea. And in fact, you know, as Jordan mentioned, it's all a big circle or cycle of things. And that fits in with my theology, too, you know, that it's not linear. It's cyclic. And everything is, you know, part of this great whole, if you like. And yet, you know, it vibrates in different ways, and we can come forth from it in unique ways, too. So it's like infinitely, a place of infinite possibility, if you like.
Yes. You know, I wanted to just comment on what you were talking about a moment ago about compassion, because that seemed really very, very true to me in terms of what I've learned from Jordan. The compassion is really a spiritual experience, and it's part of what we learn in the afterlife. And and just what you said, we take that experience here, and as we get we develop more as souls, as we grow more, as we learn more, we're more able to bring that spiritual experience of compassion, which is really just love and connectedness. It's just the sense of oneness, that we are all one, and that compassion is just a direct response to that experience. And we can take that and bring it into a physical life, into a physical body, and into relationships with embodied souls. And the experience of compassion is really an index in some ways of how much we've grown as souls, how much we're capable of that.
Right, and he mentions that home is not necessarily, you know, the planet or the experience we're having here. We're other than that. I remember as a teenager hitchhiking to Vienna, I was looking at a mountain full of forests and thinking none of that is real, and yet it's not. It's also not real either. But it's not what it seems to be. And years later, I came across a quote from the Lankavatara Sutra in the Buddhist tradition that says, "Nothing is as it seems. Neither is it otherwise." And it corroborated my view there, you know, that things are not what they seem, and yet we can't see them as totally, there's something else that can replace them. What interpenetrates them is this other, and yet once we understand that, you know, we understand that it's both and. But our minds have a hard time getting around that, because it seems to be, you know, a bit of a paradox, but life is paradox, right? And this is what I think you've discovered in this book, that it's a glorious paradox.
It is a beautiful paradox, and again, I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, because Jordan said to me that the universe, the physical universe, is really energy. It is both the physical experience of these objects we touch, and yet really underneath that is energy, and underneath that is just thought. It's that all of consciousness, the divine, God, however we want to describe this allness, thinks, has thoughts, and those thoughts can literally become energetic and can take physical forms. And so that they're both things. It is both what it appears to be, this physical form. I'm looking at a tree right now outside my window. It appears to be a physical form, but it's also energy. And at its deepest root, it's thought. It's God's thought. It's the thought of the divine, of all of consciousness that has created that experience. And so it's both things. And allowing it to be both things at once is part of enjoying that paradox and allowing that dichotomy to be true.
Fascinating stuff. Folks, I'm with Matthew McKay. We're at the end of the show. Unfortunately, we could talk for many more hours, I'm sure. But if people want to find out more about you, you have a website, right?
Yeah, SeekingJordan.com, www.SeekingJordan.com.
Right, and this book's just come out, guys, so get a copy. It's published by the always reliable New World Library, but of course you can get it in all the usual outlets. And I hope you've enjoyed this show. And let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Matthew. Next week, counselor, minister, meditation master, author, and lecturer. How does he deal with being so many things? Phil Goldberg joins me, another man from California, this time L.A. He joins me to talk about the spirituality of the Beatles. Now, that's going to be fun, spirituality of the Beatles. So join me then for that. But I want to thank Matthew McKay for a wonderful interview and also a wonderful book. And for any of us struggling with someone who's left us, this is a book of great encouragement. So thank you very much for writing it.
Thank you for having me, Paul. Really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
You're welcome. All right. Thanks, folks. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. That the Buddha gave us the formula to create a beautiful, abundant life. Did you know that Jesus gave us the formula to create a beautiful, abundant life? Did you know that both these masters taught exactly the same thing? And guess what? They did not teach the law of attraction. They taught the great paradox of prosperity. You can have anything you want. Why, you can have things you don't even know you want, but not by wanting them. Instead, put your attention on the vibrant presence of the divine within. Do that, and your life will change. It has to. That is the natural order.
Want to crack the code on the great paradox? Get Janet Connor's The Lotus and the Lily, available everywhere great books are sold.
Of spiritually conscious living start now. For a time-tested method to live with purpose and release your infinite potential, tune in to the Yoga Hour, Living the Eternal Way, with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.